Cats in Hell, a look back at Saturday Night Live with your hosts, Matt and Keith. Brought to you by Lion's Den Audio Theater. Like and subscribe to Lion's Den Audio Theater for more Lion's Den goodness. And here are your hosts, Keith and Matt.
Saturday Night Live, Season 4, Episode 7, starring Walter Matthau, originally aired on December 2nd, 1978. Hello, welcome to SN Hell. My name is Keith. With me, as always, my good buddy Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Keith. I will probably not soil myself for this episode.
Oh, good. I appreciate that. Do you want to give the thousands some context?
Yeah, a great value brand frozen pizza bites. They are so easy to make. They are such a delicious, crispy snack that you almost can't help but eat 15 of them. And you shouldn't eat 15 of them.
No, and this is not paid advertising. This is Matt going out on his own.
Side hustle.
Yeah.
Do a new angle on that one.
Yeah, that's right. And that voice you hear is someone who's joining us as a third chair for the first time in a while, though he was around for our summer episode. It's Sean. Hello, Sean. Welcome back.
Hey, glad to be back. And I have a little bit of a cold, so if you hear me sniffing, it's not me doing a John Belushi impression. I've just got a little bit of cold.
We'll get there. Yeah. So we are recording these a bunch. We're actually recording a whack together, so you might get this next sort of late-breaking news super late. But word went around yesterday, I believe, that SNL writer Brian McConaughey passed away at 81. He joined as a writer. It was actually the Frank Zappa episode we saw his first work. Matt, you might remember it. It was the one in a house where people were living, like they were renting out the house to a prison, and like John Belushi was in a cell under the stairs and Garrett was trapped in a closet. Does this ring a bell to you?
Yeah. Unfortunately, like I try to sink that episode into the recesses of my memory, but I do remember that weirdness. So it was weird.
Yeah, but we said there was something there that was awesome, too, in that one sketch. He's only with us for season 4 as a writer. Then he goes off in the 80s and 90s, and he's writing other places. He does return to SNL on a few spots. He was said to be a wonderful guy, a comedy writer's favorite comedy writer. And he was part of the writing team for SCTV, National Lampoon Magazine, and then the radio show. He founded the American Bystander. He had a few different on-screen appearances in films like Caddyshack, Strange Brew, Sleepless in Seattle, and some Woody Allen movies I'm not going to mention. Also credit with writing about a dozen episodes of Shining Time Station, if you remember that show, which I
see. Yeah. George Carlin, Ringo Starr, they swapped out, right?
Yeah, it was Ringo first and then Carlin. And then at the very end, I think it was Alec Baldwin, or maybe that was just a movie. Sad to hear of his passing. It's been a last few months have been very hard on SNL. A lot of prominent folks passing away from certainly behind the scenes. But this was another one that, you know, we don't see as much of. But when you look into him, you're like, wow, this guy did everything. Tonight is the Walter Matthau episode. Just a very broad look at Walter Matthau, one of the most celebrated actors of his era. He was successful as both a lead and a character actor, and really had, you know, 4 or 5 decades of steady, prominent employee. Arguably, he's at his peak in the 1970s, certainly remembered for his decades-long association with Jack Lemmon. They made over 10 movies together. In 1978, Walter Matthau was in 2 prominent movies that hit theaters, Neil Simon's California Suite and House Calls. For me, Walter Matthau's career really comes down to 2 main roles for me. The Grumpy Old Men stuff, which I watched them when they came out. I was early teenagers, I believe. And a bit part as Russell Long in JFK, one of my favorite movies.
Dennis the Menace comes to mind. And then the other one was that I watched when he was younger was Charade with Cary Grant, which was really, really good movie. I've been remade a few times now, but those are 3 movies. And I also remember a big trailer where I think he played Albert Einstein. He helped a couple fall in love as IQ. Albert Einstein.
Yeah, IQ.
IQ, yeah. But I just remember the trailer. That's it. Never saw the movie.
I think that's the only place I know him from is trailers. I don't think I've ever seen a Walter Matthau movie. I haven't seen Grumpy Old Men. I didn't watch Dennis the Menace. I sure as shit didn't watch any of this stuff from the 70s. I don't really know how I know who he is, but I do.
Charlie Varick was another one. Certainly. I think it was on A&E at least once a week. It used to be on A&E constantly. It would be like, your movie this week is Charlie Varick. And I'd be like, well, that was last week's movie. But yeah, I must have seen Charlie Varick in different bits and pieces, probably 75, 80 times. It was on all the time back in the day.
He was in the Bad News Bears, right? Like,
oh yeah, yeah, he was the coach. Yeah,
see, I remember hearing like nothing but good things about that movie, but I never saw it.
Well, it certainly inspired so many other movies that mm-hmm. are like, I mean, the Mighty Ducks owes their existence to Bad News Bears, you know.
Yeah, coach that doesn't want to be a coach. Yep. Yeah.
So Jane Curtin has cited Walter Matthau as her least favorite host of the period. She suggested that he was a little too silly and just wanted to kind of play around with the material. Wasn't into the prep and rehearsal, and that he was disrespectful of their working process because he just kept kind of getting distracted and getting other people distracted and just wanting to goof around. Knowing who has hosted in the first four seasons up to this point, Walter Matthau seems like such a strange choice for someone to say as the worst host. It's just it's a weird one. Any reaction to that, fellas?
It does seem pretty weird. He's just a silly old man. I mean, you just had Frank Zappa on. How could it have been worse?
Mm-hmm.
For me, I actually, hearing that makes a lot more sense watching the episode. Yep. I found like anytime he was on, it was always obviously written one way, but he decided to do it a different way. And like it just always felt like there was never any commitment to the sketch and mm-hmm. caused that sketch to just peter out. Like even his opening monologue, I thought he was going to come off as being like, you know what, here I am, this veteran actor, going to shell out and give all my experience and just fell flat because he's just like, well, I don't want to play that character anymore, so I'll play this character instead. And the joke just went in a different direction.
Yeah.
And you're like, and to the point where it's like, did he even write that himself? I wondered. Like,
there's definitely a few times where I think he might have ad-libbed a bit.
Yes. Yeah, so just hearing that goes, that makes so much more sense watching it.
Future host Maureen Stapleton is in the audience tonight. Both Matthau and Stapleton work together in the movie Plaza Suite, and he actually does a couple shout outs to her. There is one iconic SNL sketch that was written for this show, but Matthau turned it down, and we're going to see it in a couple of weeks in its final form. Aykroyd takes the role instead. 3 days after the airing of this episode, the Blues Brothers live album was released. So this is kind of the last episode before Belushi conquers the music world as well. So we are now at the cold open, and it's Belushi as Fred Silverman. Matt, we recently talked about Fred Silverman and his impact on the show.
Fresh in my mind, yeah.
Yeah, bear that in mind when we talk afterwards. So we have John Belushi as Fred Silverman looking at the schedule for the network's season. He is obviously very flustered. Gilda, as his secretary Barbara, comes in with some applesauce she has to feed to him. Fred is upset that he's had to cancel 9 shows. They were terrible, but they were just as bad as the shows that did really well over on ABC. They knock a show called David Cassidy, Man Undercover, which was actually a legit police drama that started the year 1978 and was canceled by that point. Silverman rethinks it as Donnie Osmond, Man Undercover. They wonder what can ever fit between a show about a truck driver and a cop show, and Barbara suggests a show called Roadblock. Silverman loves the idea. Well, he says he hates it. He says it's terrible, and therefore he loves it. Barbara suggests that maybe they are underestimating the intelligence of the American viewer, and she is immediately fired. Barbara gets angry and grabs Fred by the tie and says there's one thing she wants to say before she leaves, and that's live from New York. I thought this was a pretty funny piece. Belushi and Gilda were both very, very good. Double-edged sword to this one, though. On one hand, they're making fun of the network that they're on, which is always kind of funny. On the other hand, they are publicly bashing their boss, who backstage has been counting on Gilda leaving SNL for a show of her own and is really struggling in his new job. So this is another example of how the Saturday Night Live Fred Silverman relationship is going to go. All things considered, though, I really enjoyed Belushi and I really enjoyed Gilda in this one. Apparently, Belushi didn't want to do this sketch, but strong cold open.
I didn't like it so much. I think it's too much inside baseball. I think you're tuning into the show and, you know, you don't know who this guy is. You know, who gives a shit that NBC is in a distant third of the networks? It's not like it's, you know, today where we can have our fingers on things and access so easily. In 1978, I mean, unless I'm reading the Showtime rags, how the hell do I know how NBC is doing? Unless NBC is telling me that they're stinking up the joint. Anyway, I thought it was too meta. I don't appreciate the inside baseball.
I didn't mind that sketch too much. Like Keith, really enjoyed it. So yeah, no, I thought it was a really strong sketch. And the fact, like Keith said, the fact that they were just making fun of NBC, I get along with it really well. I thought it was made up about Dick Cassidy's undercover cop show.
Me too.
That, and that I makes it even better. Yeah.
So we now have the monologue. Walter Matthau comes to home base, gets a huge applause, probably one of the biggest applause we've seen yet. He does a bit where he hangs a Kleenex from his nose as part of a bet he made with someone to get a laugh in the opening. After spending the week with the staff, he's glad to come out and chat with some people he actually relates to. Matthau says he has sacrificed a lot to be there and is giving them the benefit of his fame and experience. And after all that decency, they turned on him. He started the week by telling some funny stories and jokes, and he thinks they only laugh to be polite. He says they may not dress well here at Saturday Night Live, but they are mannerly. He figures he could hold his own on the show, and he feels he has more stamina and is light years ahead of the cast in as far as taste is concerned, because some of the jokes they would have made if he hadn't stopped them would make the audience throw up. He says there isn't going to be a switch here where he drops his pants, teases dropping his pants and doesn't. There was something here, but it wasn't a great monologue. It kind of reminded me of one of Buck Henry's monologues without the crawl. So it's like the monologue without the joke. Matthau kind of has this halting delivery, which means to me, he's either relying heavily on the cue cards or he timed things out for jokes that people didn't laugh at. Can't really gauge what it was. But I mean, it wasn't a terrible monologue. It just wasn't a great one either.
I think I mentioned earlier, everything felt like it was going to go one direction and then he went into different. Like he came off as like, oh, I'm going to be the cocky actor, and then went to the more self-pitying actor, and then was going to make a joke about the pants and then stop at the commercial. That was it. And like you said, that pausing just made me think, like, did he write this himself and he's just going off his own riffing and ignoring the cue cards?
Yeah, I don't know. I think he was reading the cards, but there was a weird pace to the delivery.
Okay, first of all, tall motherfucker. Holy cow. I had no idea what a tall drink of water this guy is. I really liked that he said he sacrificed to come here. I thought that was cute. He kind of made a mention that maybe he's like, going to be too big a movie star for this affair. But he wasn't selling that at all. In fact, I found the whole thing really rambly, and it just kept going, and I hated his delivery. The audience wasn't laughing. I wasn't laughing. And other than the pop he got at the top, man, I thought this was basement tier monologue. Hated it.
He was 6'2", Walter Matthau.
Wow, he looks so much taller.
Yeah.
I thought Aykroyd was a tall guy, but it looked like he towered over Aykroyd at one point.
Dan Aykroyd, 6'1".
Okay, he's Matthau's not 6'2", if Aykroyd's 6'1".
Well, were you talking about the Nixon sketch? Because Aykroyd hunches over pretty fiercely in that one.
I'll let it go.
Okay.
He's a tall old bastard.
Our next bit is a commercial for Epoxy Dent, and it's a family around a picnic table when an older gentleman, Uncle Ned, starts telling a joke. His dentures fall out on the table. Lorraine, playing his niece, calls him out and says, "Uncle Ned, that's disgusting." The camera then pulls back to reveal season one cast member George Coe returning. He's a pitch man for Epoxydent, a new strong denture glue. Uncle Ned is about to take the Epoxydent chopper test, where he's going to hang from a helicopter by his teeth. We then see long shots of Uncle Ned flying over the neighborhood, and a title card comes over saying Epoxydent for confidence. This is a pastiche of the old crazy glue and denture cream ads. Great to see George Coe again. I laughed really hard, especially at the pullback where the old guy's hanging from the helicopter. And of course, when Lorraine just says, "Uncle Ned, that's disgusting." I really enjoyed this one.
I thought it was pretty good too. Uncle Ned, that's disgusting is definitely something I wrote down verbatim. And I also really like the idea in fake commercials, or just for products, that this is the strongest we're allowed to give you by law. I wish more products were actually like that. Like, we are not legally allowed to put more caffeine in this beverage. I think you'd move some product. Kind of like Jolt Cola used to do, you know, it's like twice the caffeine. I think there's a market for that. Give me the most legally allowed.
Well, it was the old Jerry Seinfeld pain medicine. Find what'll kill me and back it off a little bit.
It was one of my favorite sketches out of this episode. And the same thing. It felt like one of those sketches that you could have easily seen like the cast of Monty Python doing. It was just so bizarre, yet still in the realm of realism that you go, yeah, I could see some commercial going like that route.
Saturday Night Live presenting a legit stunt as well. You could tell the budget went up, eh?
I thought the same thing. I was like, I wonder if that just basically was the rest of the budget for the rest of the season.
Yeah, no, season one, they would have hung a ladder from the ceiling and just made a chopper noise off stage. You know? We're now at the Bad News Bees, a parody, of course, of Matthau's 76 hit Bad News Bears. So we have Bill Murray, Garrett, Belushi, Aykroyd, and Charlie Matthau and a couple of other extras. They're sitting around a bunkhouse as a bunch of bees at a baseball team or a camp. One of the boys finds a bee playboy and starts sizing up the woman, and they all start accusing each other of never having gone the distance. Dan is accused of never having gone all the way with a woman, and he names a girl. A group of them, jeez.
Say it.
I'm going to. He says a group of them got together in Gangstanger behind a bowling alley. Matthau then comes in as coach Mr. Buttermaker. He tells them to go to sleep, and he gets mad at them for being too young to be looking at a stag book. Murray says he's too old, and Matthau says when they're his age, they'll be lucky to stick it to the queen as much as he does. He takes the magazine with them, turns off the light, and exits the bunkhouse. Bill Murray then catches John Belushi's character pulling his stinger, and Bill starts teasing him, making everyone laugh. Matthau comes back in and say that Belushi was buzzing off. Belushi denies it, but Bill asks why there's honey all over his sheets. Matthau then sits with Belushi and tells him there's nothing wrong with doing what he was doing. Matthau calls out the other guys, saying that they've done it as well. And he even admits to having done it twice himself and says even females do it, but he doesn't know how. Matthau then says an old respected baseball player he knew was a chronic buzzer or buzz offer who did it constantly and went on to hit 3 home runs in the World Series. Turns out to be Reggie Jackson he's talking about. Mr. Buttermaker then leaves, turns the lights off, and we can see in the dark all the little boy bees are now playing with themselves. I thought this was an excellent, very smart parody. Small moot point. I wish they'd referred to Mr. Buttermaker as Mr. Honeymaker. I thought that might have been a funny joke. Because of the tightness of the camera, we could finally see how Belushi was making these little micro expressions and little movements to make them antennas go nuts around him, because he was barely moving his head, but they were going. I thought this was a very strong, strong Bees sketch, and I thought it was a very strong sketch of the year. Really well done.
At first, I wasn't sure. Like, when Dan Aykroyd made that comment, I was like, wait, are they talking about, maybe, you know, I actually thought, oh, maybe they meant actually like stinging somebody. And then as it progressed, I was like, oh no, that was a joke that just, wow, would not work anymore. That's for sure. Bill Murray's delivery of that line, why is there honey all over your sheets? Oh, yeah. I cracked up on that one. That was a great one. As well as bending your barb. all the euphemisms were really funny. Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. It was really well done. And again, John Belushi, just like you said, that one antenna, you got more laughs than Walter Matthau did.
I don't know. Do you think you could say gang stang on TV today?
You might get away with it in this context, but it would be iffy.
It would be pretty.
Very, very iffy.
Walter doesn't give a shit about reading the cards, eh?
He's just
tearing those things down. He's probably one of the worst I've ever seen doing it. Staring at the cards, getting his lines down, and then looking back at you. I thought Bill was extra good as the bully bee. And, of course, the swinging antenna was hilarious.
This is a momentous moment, Matt, because this is the last Bees sketch. And our Bees were the first recurring characters going all the way back to episodes 1 and 2.
Well, shit.
This is it. Yeah, I announced prior that was the last Bees sketch. I was using a bad source at that point in time. But this is it, the end of the line for the official Bees. I'm sure Belushi wasn't losing any sleep over it.
Yeah, no doubt. But I mean, it went out with a bang. I thought this was a really strong one, even though I think Walter Matthau is teetering on so bad it's good work. It's this was as funny as they've been.
Yeah. The only other one that might have been this funny, and it's going back to season one, it was the Elliot Gould one where they were the Mexican killer bees, but it turned into this whole thing about Dave Wilson, the director, was an alcoholic and they fired him. And
I do remember the Mexican killer bees.
Yeah, that's the only one that was as good as that. We're now off to the Olympia Cafe. These are all written by Don Novello, these ones. So we have Belushi as Pete. He's taking orders on the phone and he's hollering out the orders to Nico, played by Bill Murray. Pete goes out to unclog the toilet. Jane, playing a customer, tells Nico that she wants her cheeseburger cooked more. Nico, with a very thin grasp of the English language, mistakes more to mean she wants another burger. She then asks Dan to cook her burger more, and he just brings her one. Garrett, playing another patron, says he sees a roach, and Bill and Dan's character name is George, kill the roach, spraying Raid all over the counter and including on some of the burgers. Jane then tries to pay George for her lunch, but he tries to charge her for two cheeseburgers. Jane has a serious problem with that, and George tells her to wait for Pete. Walter Matthau then comes in with Brian Doyle Murray and their representatives of Coca-Cola. They're trying to get the cafe to switch from Pepsi to Coke. Matthau gets the luck of picking Nico. So Matthau is playing a fast-talking salesman who is speaking to someone who barely understands English. Every time Matthau talks about Coke or says Coke, Nico says no Coke, Pepsi. He finally talks Nico into bringing Coke into the restaurant and leaves. Pete then comes back and Jane tries to get the issue resolved. Gilda, as a regular customer, comes over and orders a burger. George gives her Jane's old one, I happen to note. She tells Pete that she's getting married and will be leaving her job. To celebrate her marriage, Pete gives her a bag of chips. Zweibel and Doyle Murray come in carrying a bunch of Coca-Cola merchandise. And in order to resolve the issue with Jane, Pete gives her four bags of chips. And she then asks for a Pepsi and he says, no Pepsi, only Coke. And then yells Coke, Coke, Coke to Nico. As a top-to-bottom sketch with a resolve, with a story that starts and resolves, this actually might have been the best of the Olympia Cafes. In some ways, it felt like the other ones were sort of setting up. They were subdued and were like setting up for some big laughs at this one. Certainly not how it was, but we were laughing at jokes before they were even delivered because we've gotten to know these people. There was a lot of quick in and outs with the characters, which really worked well, as this is supposed to be a very busy restaurant cafe on a very busy street. He was kind of the antagonist early on, but I'm starting to feel a little bad for Pete here.
This is definitely the best one of these that I've ever seen as well. Bill was hilarious in it. The excessive chemical spray down of the counter amongst everybody's food was terrific. The Coke guy looks a bit like a Nazi with the brown and the red. got real Nazi vibes on the red badge. Bill's vacant stare sold the whole thing for me. Jane was great. I thought it was long, but it was super fast paced and really big pop for the no Pepsi Coke line.
I guess I've never seen the other Olympia sketches. Hearing that this was the best one makes me go, oh, at least I'm not missing out on too much. I didn't care for this episode.
No.
The sketch, and like I guess that's it, maybe because I don't know all the characters and they've been reoccurring. Like, it dragged on way too long for such a very subtle conclusion of no Pepsi, just Coke. And again, now maybe going back, if I've watched all the previous ones and seen this, I'd be like, oh, okay, because you guys obviously really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'm thinking the setup from the other sketches was crucial to liking this one, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. It's been a nice build, and I think the reliance on knowing you know, the dynamic of the characters. Belushi's the boss and Dan is kind of like this cantankerous smoker, and Bill has that innocent, vacant Forrest Gump expression, and just the general frustration of the customers. Yeah, there's definitely payoff here that's that has more value if you've been following along.
In bed on the night of her parents' 25th anniversary, Gilda as Hillary and her husband Mark, played by Bill Murray, are staying in her childhood bedroom. She says she used to dream about her future husband there and practiced by kissing her pillow. Bill says she needs more practice, and they go in to start kissing each other. Matthau, as Gilda's dad, comes in at a really bad time. He notices that the pair of them have moved the two twin beds together. Bill makes a joke, but Matthau really doesn't care. Matthau joins them in bed, where he and Gilda start reminiscing and basically ignoring everything Bill has to say, including after Matthau tries to blow up a pillow. Mark offers one of his pillows. Matthau doesn't want it. There's a very quick little exchange with the pillow. This delves into Matthau saying he could never understand why Gilda's character Hillary married Mark in the first place. Gilda says, well, it's my husband and he's here. Mark gets annoyed. Hillary apologizes. The father and daughter start singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat in a round. When Bill joins in, Hillary says he's throwing her off. Gilda then starts to sing Tora, Laura, Laura, and Matthau goes to sleep on her shoulder. Gilda then says she's going to go say goodnight to her mother, leaving Mark and Dad in the bed together. Bill wakes up in the dark and cuddles in with the dad. The dad wakes up. Bill then tells the dad to go to sleep with his own wife, and he'll sleep with his own wife. Bill was excellent, trying to be part of the conversation, but continually getting shut out. Gilda and Matthau were very kind of touchy and cute together as father and daughter. Sketch was good, but at the very end, there's this very long bit taking us out. It almost seems as if somebody forgot a last line, or maybe the camera was just lingering too much. I also thought the final line of Bill saying, you go sleep with your wife and I'll sleep with mine, was kind of a rude and flippant remark that really didn't jive with the rest of the sketch. So it was kind of a jarring ending, but I thought it was an okay sketch in some ways and kind of bad in others.
Yeah, to me, I think this was my favorite of the Walter Matthau sketches, where he was more of the lead. Like, I mean, he was in the B one, which was good, but basically a lot of the same comments you made. I really enjoyed the fact, even how when he's just started bad mouthing Mark, and they're like, who is he again? And he's like, he's Mark. I married him. I love that bit. And the same thing. Yeah, the ending to me, making fun of Bill Murray and Bill Murray playing that character of like, oh, I just wanted to be liked by you, but I knew I couldn't. When he made that comment, it was just like, huh, yeah, it didn't really work.
Now, this one wasn't for me, guys. I thought this was really slow and clunky and awkward. I got a couple of chuckles, a sensible chuckle magazine from Walter being nasty to Bill. And I really was kind of hoping his growing frustration at being ignored was going somewhere. But I don't know if they just went a little too real with it or something. But the pacing of it was terrible. And again, maybe, yeah, I mean, you kind of mentioned, Keith, that maybe somebody missed something or the camera lingered or something. And I don't know what the cause was, but the results were on screen and they were dreadful. Watch it back. The audience did not like this either.
We are now off to Weekend Update. And this one is brought to you by Logs. It's the pantyhose for tree stumps. Pope John Paul II just beat the 31-day record of John Paul I, being the longest pope ever named John Paul. And then there's a shot of what looks like him throwing a 9-year-old, said to be an excommunication. A photo of Jim Jones comes up. Bill Murray says it's Chuck Barris in town with a new version of the Gong Show. This one actually gets boos. This is the first episode to happen after Jonestown, and the show is told, do not touch that subject with a 10-foot pole, and rightfully so. I would not want that in the hands of these folks. Bill then talks about the murder of Mayor Mosconi and Harvey Milk, who he calls Harry Milk down in San Francisco. Says Lorraine is reporting from San Francisco. It's actually a video of Mao's funeral, but Lorraine says it's San Francisco and it's in the predominantly gay Chinatown. Mattel in East Germany is selling Nazi memorabilia. Mattel says, I'm innocent. I'm only filling orders. Bit about Irish Spring contraceptive. And then Belushi comes in to talk about helping the needy over the Christmas holidays. Says it's just as rough for the non-needy. Talks a bit about trying to get a pony when he was a kid and sharing a joint with his friend Steve, where they were just passing the same joint back and forth. The suicide rate going up because people have to spend time with their family. He's angry about sap getting stuck on your hands during from Christmas trees. Jane tries to interrupt, and he starts ranting on Thanksgiving as well. Says he spent most of his Thanksgiving in a hotel in L.A., got no dinner, and had a veal cutlet from room service. He then goes back to the pony and talking about shooting families with a shotgun. He then does his fall out of the chair dying thing. So about the whole Weekend Update here, holy dark. I mean, we've got dead popes, we've got Jonestown, we've got Harvey Milk, Red China, Nazis shooting families. I sort of said, are they sure Michael O'Donoghue has left the show? This was not a great Weekend Update. I didn't mind the darkness, but I just thought some of the jokes were there. I did kind of mind the Jonestown darkness. I don't know why, but that's one of them things to me that you just keep your hands off of. Belushi thing was all right. It was definitely a slower build, and he didn't go as wild as he has, but I thought it was pretty darn good.
Yeah, I was like, wow, Booze. I don't think I've really watched much Weekend Update where I've ever heard Booze. Usually I come groans, but actual audible boo. As for John Belushi, I really liked his bit. I think he saved. But I was like, oh, okay, this is the John Belushi where Chris Farley really started to imitate.
Yeah, the influence is obvious, especially when he's doing that one where he falls out of the chair and stuff. Yeah.
Keith, I'm going to have to disagree with you. I thought this was an extremely strong installment of Weekend Update. JP2, I mean, that gets a laugh out of me right away. I do not think you should joke about Jim Jones. I agree. I don't know the timeline, like how much graphic detail did they know when this hits the air? But I mean, they knew enough for the audience to boo them. So fuck you a little bit. That's in poor taste. You shouldn't joke about Jim Jones. Those are dead kids. Lorraine saying with complete earnesty, grief-stricken Chinese homosexuals, certainly made me forget about it. I thought her whole segment was hilarious, and I really liked the way she says homosexual. And I don't really think that segment gets on the air today either. There is a very dark tone to the whole thing. It's incredibly sleazy. I find this whole episode weird and sleazy and kind of all over the place. I thought Bill and Jane are super comfortable with each other. This was as good as I've seen her with a partner. Certainly better than she's ever been with Aykroyd. And I really like Belushi's going off the rails character in general. I mean, I don't like the holidays either, pal, so I really just agreed with him the whole time. And when he said, if anybody even mentions my pony, and he fell over, it was laugh out loud funny. I thought this was a sleazy, coke-fueled, awesome edition of Weekend Update.
And for the record, it's 2 weeks after Jonestown. So.
Okay, so you probably don't have graphic detail yet, but you know a bunch of people are dead, so too soon.
I'm thinking about the news footage, and I don't know. I think you would have had enough.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
And we now have a new dick. It's Franken and perhaps Davis. I think it's Davis that wrote this one. Nixon is writing a letter to Strom Thurmond congratulating on his win. He is asking Thurmond to support the repeal of the 22nd Amendment, keeping someone from becoming president more than twice. He signs the letter with a name he finds in a phone book. Lorraine is a secretary, buzzes him and says that Ernie is there to see him. Nixon asks her to send Ernie in. Ernie is played by Walter Matthau. Turns out he was behind Chappaquiddick, poisoning Mama Cass, starting the Chicago riots, and he's working for Nixon to get him reelected. Ernie has printed up some bumper stickers asking if a country can really be free if a man can only be president twice. Nixon finds that bumper sticker a tad too busy, and he presents a bumper sticker saying, tanned, rested, and ready. Nixon likes it, but wants the one he thought up, which says, the new dick. Nixon likes it because it's short, sweet, and everyone wants to see it. Nixon is wanting Ernie to get the bumper stickers out, but also to put the country in the dumper. Ernie tells Nixon he has a plan, and it's to get the Teamsters to ask for 12% pay hike, which will cause inflation to go out of control. Nixon also thinks you can get some photos of Sadat having sex with a Jewish girl, and to put the photos out all over the world, most importantly in the Middle East. This will help destroy Carter's credibility for his work at the Camp David Accords. Matthau suggests that Gerry Ford should be Nixon's running mate this time around, and he says a good slogan would be the president's for president. Nixon is excited and calls the family in, tells Ernie to take off. And we have Bill and Gilda coming in as David and Julie Nixon Eisenhower, and Jane returning as Pat Nixon. Nixon asks them what kind of wish they would want right now. David wants a chocolate factory. Pat says she just wants to be left alone, and Julie wants her daddy to be reelected. He then reveals the bumper stickers and says they are short, sweet, and everyone wants to see it. And Pat says it's short, sweet, but nobody wants to see it. This sketch was way too long. There was a lot of unnecessary stuff in it. I have kind of been the in-house champion of these Nixon sketches from the beginning, but this one was a little rough. The first bit was great. A lot of good jokes there and an excellent premise. Matthau was obviously reading the cards, and his pacing drove this sketch to a crawl. There was no need for the second part after Nixon goes back and starts typing again. It just brought in some folks for some pretty meh impressions, and leading to a weak punchline that you could kind of see coming a mile away. A little footnote here, though, for this sketch. David Eisenhower becomes the first person on SNL to have been impersonated by three different people. Dan voiced him in a sketch back in season one. Chevy then played him also in season one, and now Bill's playing him now. So that's a little footnote of historical import. But I was really disappointed with this sketch because I thought it started very strong and quickly went into the dumper.
I think I'm pretty much with you on that. First of all, as soon as I saw Nixon, I was like, hey, you know how I feel about the Nixon stuff. But I've found this episode pretty off the rails, so I was willing to give anything a shot at this point. I know this doesn't make sense because of how it happens chronologically, but Nixon was very Mr. Burns. I thought the new dick was a pretty funny bumper sticker. And generally, it's a better use of Nixon, at least, in these historical flashbacks. I really don't think you can say Jew lover anymore. It was way too long. But Bill Murray wanting a chocolate bar factory did get a laugh out of it.
Yeah, agree to disagree. I actually enjoyed the sketch. It was once Walter Matthau left that I felt it started clipping along again. Bill Murray was great. I knew that punchline was coming. I was okay to wait for it to get to its conclusion. I think even now, just watching that sketch, I was like, they could redo that again with another certain wannabe president writing letters, and it would work. So yeah, no, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, you could do it again with another president coming back. You could even bring in the son-in-law and the daughter, too.
Yeah, okay, like, I don't get all these references, but you switch around and it would work.
We're now off to Woman to Woman, and I think this was written by Rosie Schuster and Ann Beats. This is our second installment. It's a television show hosted by Connie Carson, played by Gilda, a career woman who makes her career talking to other career women about their careers. And tonight she's speaking to Vanessa Lake, played by Lorraine, who is a professional model. Carson wonders if Vanessa worries about getting old or gaining weight. Vanessa says she doesn't. She's just one of them people that can't gain weight. Carson then wonders if Lorraine has a perm or if her hair is natural. Vanessa says her hair is natural. Connie then wonders if she should get a perm, but Vanessa says it's probably too late as perms are gone out, though it would have looked great. Connie, seething with jealousy, then says that Vanessa is the type of woman that other women love to hate. Vanessa is fine with that because all her closest friends are women who other women tend to hate. Connie then asks if people take it for granted that Vanessa is stupid, and Vanessa says she's not stupid. She's quite intelligent. Connie then assumes that Vanessa sleeps around, but Vanessa says she's married to her best friend. Connie then says she'll be back next week asking Liz Taylor about how she copes with the press hounding her about how fat she is. First of all, with this sketch, both performances were great. They were both doing kind of over-the-top characters, but not so over-the-top it was obnoxious. As with the other Woman to Woman, we saw there's something in the writing here that's very real about subsections of certain left-leaning groups, exemplified by like the Connie character, and her assumption that because Lorraine's character is a rich, successful, and beautiful model, she must not be happy or smart or living a very clean life. This could be played today. It's characters like Connie that I kind of get a kick out of.
I thought this was a fantastic display of performances. When Gilder pretty much straight up called her a whore, I thought that was really funny. I thought Lorraine stole the show. This was like a fascinating little character sketch of her as a coked up 70s model. And I thought it was hugely successful, and she was great in it. I loved it.
I really enjoyed the performances. I felt like there was a lot of good things in the sketch, but I felt like it was one of those ones that it just needed another work through to be really solid. I felt like if they could have made Gilda Radner just a little bit really more blatant with the hypocrisy, it would have worked. Yeah. Because I felt sometimes it's like, is she being catty or is she just, you know, choices just weren't strong enough, I think. It just needed another, like, polish.
So in the annals of Saturday Night Live, this episode is credited as not having a musical guest. To those annals, I say, fuck you. There is a musical guest tonight, and it is Garrett Morris. Matt, is Garrett Morris tonight's musical guest?
Absolutely. I was annoyed as fuck when they were doing the upfront stuff at the top. Yeah. They just slid it by without even mentioning him. Come on.
Now
he deserved the nod in the credits.
At first, I said, well, they should have credited him. And then I'm like, well, he's already on the show, but the Blues Brothers got a credit last week. Whether the annals recognize it or not from here on out, anyone who's listening this, if you're ever talking to somebody about this episode of Saturday Night Live, say, yeah, you know the one. Walter Matthau was the host. Garrett Morris was a musical guest. That's part of our public service, Matt.
Yeah, don't talk to me about the Blues Brothers.
So Walter Matthau was a fan of classical music, was known to take it and listen to it in his trailers. When he was asked to do the show, he said he wanted someone to sing, and Garrett Morris was that someone. Matthau requested that he sang Dalla Swapace from Mozart's Don Giovanni, and that's what we get. Garrett Morris with a small orchestra features some of the SNL band, which is extra cool. We have Howard Shore conducting, Lou Marini on flute, Cheryl Hardwick on piano. Those are the three I saw. So Garrett sings, Matthau loves it, says they'll be right back with more of the regular crap. I adored this. Garrett was absolutely a perfect musical guest. A nice change to see, you know, we got to see some of the band members in tuxes, you know, and to see Garrett performing as it's supposed to be done without the comical crawl, which I always enjoy, but it's nice to see it this way as well. One of my favorite performances on the show is going to come years later. It's Pavarotti, Vanessa Williams. They do some Christmas songs together. And I do think that the breadth of what can be presented musically on this show has always been a little more narrow than it needs to be. Of all the concessions that I've heard people making for hosts on this show, not too many, but there's been a few. This is the sweetest one. So well done, Matthau. Well done, Garrett.
I think, yeah, Garrett, when you told me that he was the musical guest, I thought, oh, he must have left the series and he was just coming back as a musical guest. When he showed up in the credits, I was like, oh, okay, I'll see where this goes. I think, unfortunately, the acoustics of the studio did not help him. Like, I mean, he did a really good job. I'm not saying he was awful, but it was an open stage studio. So it had that little drawback, but he did phenomenal. Again, with Walter Matthau, when he was introducing it, he started off being like, oh, I'm cultured. And I thought, okay, he's going to be snobby. And then he made that one comment, be like, but you know, what do I really know? And I was like, oh, way to ruin the joke. It was nice. And I won't lie, I was sort of hoping Garrett Morris was going to come back and do a second song, and was a little disappointed that it was just the one song.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't want opera on my late night TV, on my cool late night TV show. Don't be out there giving me opera. But this is a little special because it is Garrett and it is the house band. And, you know, they sit there so much and they put in the work week after week that they absolutely deserve the opportunity to shine. And gosh, shine do they ever. Everybody performed wonderfully. And just because I don't want opera on, but it was still super cool. And it was, I think they should have just given him the credit. It's shitty that they didn't.
It is now our next sketch, The Surplus Store. Walter Matthau plays a military surplus store supplier, and he's on the phone making a deal when Garrett enters as Olin, one of his employees, carrying a bunch of Belgian cartridge belts. The store is teeming with stock, and Matthau's character doesn't quite know where they can go, but he tells Garrett to bring them to the back. Lorraine then comes in from Shot Down, and this is a specialty boutique that deals in some of the same things as Matthau, but in a kitschy way, supplying stuff like this for the young disco crowd. She is trying to return some canteens that she bought. She tried to use them as purses. She demonstrates putting her keys in the canteen, but says the hole is too small for things to come out. Matthau won't return them, and Lorraine starts crying because her boyfriend isn't interested in her as a woman anymore. Jane then comes in as an Eastern European immigrant named Vesina Segula, who we will see later, and this is Jane complete with ridiculous accent and babushka. She's looking for 9 sets of snow boots. Matthau says he doesn't sell retail, and he gets Garrett to get rid of the communist. Matthau then tries to console Lorraine. He tells her she's not a second or an irregular, but she's the genuine article. Dan Aykroyd then enters as the effeminate Bruno Wald from the store Both Sides Now, which is implied to be a store that appeals to folks from the alternative lifestyle. And he's looking for a bunch of Boy Scout pants because he's doing a theme window and he needs British Army walking shorts and lederhosen and pistol belts and all sorts of things like that. Bruno and Olin go into the back room to seek out such stock. Matthau decides he will take the canteens back from Lorraine and tells her that he'll give her half price, but tells her to keep that deal to herself. He then wonders what he's going to do with his quote unquote fruity canteens. And then it dawns on him that Bruno is out back and might want to buy them. There was something about this sketch that I absolutely loved. I mean, there were weird parts some of the language wasn't great. Maybe Matthau was a bit too touchy-feely and kissy with Lorraine's character. But there was a really neat self-contained bit about this sketch. It reminded me of the Scotch tape bit from the Fred Willard episode. Kind of makes me wonder if Don Novello wrote this one as well. I thought this was the most comfortable Matthau was, the least he relied on the cue cards, and definitely like the most Matthau-like character. I didn't laugh a lot at this, but there was enough about it that I really, really, really enjoyed it, and I can't really put my finger on what that is.
He was very touchy-feely, and then like he kept asking, how old are you? 11? And then he'd go in for a kiss.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I was curious to see how it was going to wrap itself up, but I thought it actually, okay, had a good ending. That part worked, but didn't really care about it. And yeah, with Walter Matthau asking her age constantly and then kissing her and holding her just made it really uncomfortable.
What a dirty, sleazy, late 70s New York sketch this is. This is definitely a product of its environment, absolutely. You know, when Dan Aykroyd came out as this clearly openly gay character, you don't get away with this in 1978 on primetime, I don't think.
No.
This is pretty racy television for the time. And I enjoyed it. Jane was terrific as that Russian. and I just thought everybody was on. Matthau does seem to have settled in a bit. Don't get me wrong. I think he's doing a wretched job. But at the very least, he seems to have settled somewhat. And yeah, the whole thing just has a slime to it tonight. This is a very slimy show, episode is what I'm trying to say.
Did you like this, Matt?
Yes.
Okay. We now get an airing of a commercial. This is for the Battle for the Network TNAs. We saw this in the Rolling Stones episode at the beginning of the year, Matt. Sean, your first look at it. So this is another shot at Fred Silverman, a lot of the ABC content he developed while he was over at the helm. It's a parody of Battle of the Network Stars. And it's pushing an upcoming special that has attractive and fit women with nice chests and rear ends doing sports in skimpy clothing. This is actually one of the very first SNL commercials I ever saw. You know, I recognized what it is. You know, it doesn't get any laughs out of me, though. Sean, what are you thinking?
To me, yeah, I watched it and I just immediately thought of just recently with the Globe or Emmy where Barbie won. And still, whoever hosted just basically summed up the entire movie as a big boob joke.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize, like, the whole movie was about pushing how women can't be taken serious. This sketch just fell really flat. And it just, to me, I just was like, okay.
Matt, any changes from how you saw it the first time?
I don't remember how I saw it the first time, but I mean, it was kind of a waste of time.
Our last segment of the night is a Mr. Bill sketch. It is Mr. Bill is Late. The title screen gets a huge ovation from the crowd. Mr. Bill is running late, so Sluggo, Spot, and Mr. Hands are hanging out. And Mr. Hands gets Spot to roll over, and he squishes him like a rolling pin type deal. And then they jump through a fire ring, which catches poor Spot on fire. He is then sent to fetch Mr. Bill's newspapers, and his little Spot is crushed by a bunch of newspaper. Mr. Bill comes in. He's devastated to see that Spot has been maimed, and he's going to finally punch Mr. Sluggo in the face. Mr. Hand then squishes him before he has the chance. Another Mr. Bill. The formula was shaken up a little bit here, and I actually kind of enjoyed this one.
It was so cruel. This one was just sadism. Mr. Hand is a serial killer. Absolutely. Richard Ramirez is Mr. Hand. Here's your dead dog, you fucking loser. That's what I got from this. It was evil.
That was one of my notes that I made was, wow, Mr. Bill got the strongest reaction out of all the sketches. That's what people really wanted to see there this week.
We now go to the good nights. Walter Matthau says, hey, Maureen, to Maureen Stapleton, good night. The cast minus Belushi are all on stage. It really looks like a sparse group because there's no band there with them. But everyone seems pretty jovial. Let's wrap it all up. The host, I thought he was very good at, but more than any other host, I found his pacing and his reliance on the cue cards made him a little tad slow at times and even sloppy. He definitely brought down some sketches. I don't think anything was brought down to the level where it actually like sucked. I kind of wonder like if the pacing was so bad that something was cut at the 11th hour mid show. They're like, okay, we can't do that, so we'll just throw on the Network TNAs. There's a definite Walter Matthau vibe, and I thought he stuck with it throughout the show. He never played against type at any point. Could be a good thing, could be a bad thing. All things considered, I thought he did a good job, and maybe he should have been one that maybe they tried out later after having gone through the process once, maybe a second time he would have been maybe more comfortable or maybe more willing to listen to Jane and prepare and not rely on the cue cards.
I did not care for him. Like, I he was just bad. Everything, you know, reading the cue cards, especially hearing the comment that you made earlier that he just wasn't taking notes. And yeah, any episode he was in slowed down immensely because of it. He, out of the three episodes now that I've been on, he's been the worst. Now, that said, that was, he's been up against Buck Henry and Anthony Perkins. So, you know, stiff competition, but it just goes to show what happens when you have a guest star that just doesn't want to be there.
Yeah, or at least put the work in, right?
Yeah.
I'm with Sean. I thought he was awful. I thought it was one of the worst monologues that we've ever seen. That was like a 0 out of 10 monologue for me. I thought it stank. His insistence on reading the cue cards is borderline Zappa-esque. I thought he was dreadful, and that the cast carried the show.
Music. I thought Garrett singing in a serious manner was fantastic. I mentioned it before. I loved that the band members were there showing another side of their talents. I mean, it wasn't the full band, and I only personally saw 3 or 4. But yeah, what a nice break from the ordinary.
Yeah, agreed. I think Garrett did a good job. Like I said, wish he had a second song. Yeah, I forgot that Howard Shore used to be the band leader on SNL, which just goes to show, like, yeah, how fantastic and how talented everybody was on SNL. Like,
definitely a nice break from the ordinary. Garrett's very talented. Having said that, I don't want this to be the norm. I want them to get back to business and show me the hot pop acts of the day.
All right. So, guys, what was your worst sketch of the night?
For me, the worst sketch of the night I had was the restaurant sketch. Way too long. And so many different things going on that it just, it came off a bit of a mess.
For sure.
My least favorite sketch of the night was the goodnight sketch with Bill Murray and Gilda and Walter Matthau going to bed. I thought that was really terribly paced, poorly written, poorly performed. I really hated it top to bottom. And it was just kind of weird. Like, you know, daddy's still trying to put his little girl to bed in front of her husband. I was uncomfortable with the whole thing.
My least favorite was New Dick. Really enjoyed the first like 20% of the Nixon sketch, and it went way downhill. And for me to come out hard on a Nixon sketch is pretty saying something. So yeah, we've got three different choices there. New Dick, In Bed, and Olympia Cafe. What was the best sketch of the night, guys?
Dentures, hands down. I love, like, it was great. It was great. Like, just so bizarre. Yet again, something that you could have seen done. Yeah, I thought that was their best one.
Yeah, epoxy dent. Yeah, Matt?
I don't often pick this segment because it kind of lives outside the realm of the show in its own way. But I would be remiss if I didn't give it to Weekend Update, which I thought it was the strongest segment in a while. And I thought Bill and Jane worked way better together than usual. Great side person in Belushi. And the jokes were just weird and kind of fucked up, which I appreciated.
I was torn and torn between three: Woman to Woman, Olympia Cafe, and The Bees. I actually went with Olympia Cafe because, like I said, and Sean, from your perspective, I totally understand why it's your worst sketch, because it's the same reason why it's my best. This felt like the culmination of a build of about a season, you know, of sketches. I really, really enjoyed this Olympia Cafe, where a lot of the other ones I kind of smiled at but didn't laugh out loud at. I could have went with The Bees. I could have went with Woman to Woman. Even the Surplus Store had some really cool things about it. And in some ways, even the cold open appealed to me. Who's your star of the night, guys?
John Belushi. I thought, watching from what I saw in the first seasons to now, man, he really upped his game. He was really strong in all of them. And basically, in the B sketch, even just slowly moving his head to get that antenna to move, was, like, it killed it. And he was really good. Like, even his voice as sort of the whiny B. I thought he was really good. And then his Weekend Update was strong, too.
Bill Murray was it for me. I thought he was great in Olympia. I thought he was a great Bully B. And in that bed sketch, I at least felt that there might have been a rising tension from him. And he really came out of Weekend Update with a stronger performance than I think we've been used to seeing so far.
I got to be honest. This is probably the first time where I could have honestly made a justification for picking any of the cast. All of them could have been the star of the night. I went with Belushi, though. Sean touched on it. He did the cold open really well. his Weekend Update thing was a slower build and he didn't go as over the top crazy with it. Pete was really good. I just thought Belushi was amazing tonight. And that's really saying something because I thought everyone was really good tonight. Overall, you know, this episode doesn't have any tippy top shelf sketches from me that will probably be on the top 10. I don't know. And because of that, I sort of expected a kind of boring night. On the contrary, though, I had a lot of laughs. And I think the secret to this episode was the writing. There was definitely some dark tinges all over the place and definitely some un-PC things. But this whole episode was extremely solid. Despite being like a lauded stage performer, Matthau was a tad or more out of his element. He, like Jane said, he might have goofed around too much. He did rely on the cue cards. I can't rank him as one of the worst hosts either. So we had an excellent show with a very awesome musical guest and a host who kind of was average or slightly above or slightly below, depending on how you want to look at it. The show was probably slower paced than it should have been. And I did find some low energy, and that may have come from just Matthau's vibe, or maybe people are tired. Christmas is coming. I certainly didn't suffer as much as I have on other nights, and really enjoyed a lot of sketches, which is what brings me to the dance. All things considered, though, I am going above average on this one. I'm giving it a 7 out of 10.
I haven't been around as long, but just with the 3 episodes, I'm giving it a 6.
I thought this was a real mess of an episode. I do think the writing was strong. I thought Walter Matthau was pretty terrible, and that the cast really carried the whole thing. I really thought this was one of the more sleazier cocaine dripping episodes that we've seen. I think this was pretty lecherous at times, and that's what I want out of my late night TV. I'm good with that. The host was really bad, and yeah, I was fine with the musical guest. We're certainly getting no demerits there, but it's not the hot pop act I want to see either. So the sketches were pretty hit and miss. You know, despite what I've been saying the whole time, I really think I enjoy how just gross and grimy this episode was, certainly more than it might seem to have been at a cursory glance. I think it was above average, even though there was a lot working against it. I would give it a 6.5.
So with my 7, Matt 6.5, Sean 6, evens it out at 6.5. Matt, you're right on the nose. Folks at the IMDb like it. 7.3 is what they give it, which is 1.2 higher than our average. 1.2 higher than our average. We're not too far off from our 1.5 exchange rate established back in episode 2. That's holding steady, Matt, which I'm really enjoying.
Yeah, it's pretty fun to see.
So yeah, that was it for Walter Matthau. We don't see him back as host ever again. So, Sean, thank you very much. You're going to be back in about 2 or 3 episodes. Matt, next week, do you remember who the host is and the musical guest?
Eric Idle. Yeah, yeah. Oh, and Kate Bush.
Yeah, Eric Idle, Kate Bush, and Adrian is going to be joining us for that.
Looking forward to Kate Bush, too.
Yeah, yeah. So, Matt and I will be back in about a week, but until then, we'll be waving bye to the killer bees here in SN Hell.